Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Charity Charge Show. Today, I have with us Terry Beswick, who is the Executive Director of the Golden Gate Business Association. Terry, thank you so much for being our guest.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me, Stephen.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the big reasons I wanted to have you on is not only, you know, the work that you've been doing more recently at the Golden Gate Business Association, but I wanted to have a conversation with you about your entire career. And I know a lot of that's really been in service, working at different organizations and trying to find different ways to help out, make the world a better place. So I'm just curious, I guess, as a start, do you mind telling us a little bit about where you started your career in the nonprofit sector?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. I was a theater student. I was, kind of a stereotypical, young gay theater student in San Francisco in the early 1980s. And that was just at the beginning of the AIDS pandemic, of course. And, I was kind of coming out as a gay man, actually, at that time. Involved in community theater and that kind of thing. But, when the AIDS epidemic came, it really kind of tapped into my social conscience. On a deeper level, though, it really tapped into my fears around that epidemic and my concern also for, especially young gay and bisexual men, younger than me at the time, who were just coming to terms with their sexuality and were doing it in the midst of this viral pandemic that, equated sexual contact with disease and death. And, so it was hard enough for me, but I really was compelled by the concern about kids that were, having to deal with coming out as being gay at the same time as dealing with this pandemic. And so I got involved in doing street theater, we put on protests and sort of picked targets, the federal building, Nancy Pelosi's office, or, the state senator's office, or whatever, whoever was not doing enough at the time, we thought, or were taking the wrong approach on fighting that epidemic. And because there was a lot of fear mongering going on, and the federal government during the Reagan era was very slow to move. We think about comparing it to COVID now. COVID has been miraculous in terms of the response on a federal level in comparison to the glacial pace of the response in the early mid 1980s. And so that was my big motivator to get involved in doing activism. And then activism kind of led to a special focus for me on treatment advocacy, research into effective and safe treatments for HIV and AIDS. And so we formed a number of different organizations really kind of contributed to the creation of the San Francisco model, which has been used as a public health model for a response to AIDS and now to COVID even throughout the world. And so I think, so that was really the genesis of it for me. It was kind of a combination of theater and activism. We would put on skits each of us would play a role. Oftentimes we would, get arrested through acts of civil disobedience. And it was a very, it was a tragic time, with so many of us, getting infected and dying in the gay community. And it was also exhilarating. Many of us that survived look back on it as being one of the greatest times in our lives. It's kind of like being, part of a war.
Yep. Explain to us more of the plays that you did. I mean, were the times and such announced for those sort of like productions, or you just found certain areas around town and you showed up and put it on?
Yeah, later the groups that we were involved in, you know, the early group is called Citizens for Medical Justice, and then AIDS Action Pledge, and then we kind of morphed all that into ACT UP after Larry Kramer founded ACT UP in New York. And so there were many ACT UP chapters all around the country, and I was actually the first national coordinator of the ACT UP network. I think it was the spring of 1988 that we had a week-long series of direct action protests coordinated all around the state on or around the country on different issues. On a local level, we would just, you know, pick a target, you know, and often, you know, it would be something like the INS to protest the federal government's exclusion of HIV positive people from traveling into the United States, which was just, you know, contrary to any, you know, public health science in terms of controlling the pandemic at that time. And so, you know, we would go to the INS office and we would, sit in the lobby or whatever, and, you know, make sure that the media was... So yeah, we would announce it in advance to the media and to our fellow compatriots, just try to get as much attention to the issue as we could. You know, and sometimes it was effective in bringing attention to an issue, and sometimes not. But that was kind of like the genesis of my activism that I still continue to, I still identify as an activist in terms of just trying to, you know, and the idea here is just pick a target, figure out who and what needs to take action on what specific issue, and then go and try to affect that change. And sometimes it was the theater scenes that we would put on the direct action protests. And there were many, many of those all across the country. You know, we blockade the FDA and NIH. And sometimes it was just getting the door open so some of us could go in and negotiate, you know, early access to treatments, things like that, or for more money for a different program to fight AIDS. And so that was the thrust of it. It was sort of twofold. It was the direct action, media attention, and then it was, you know, learning the policy issues and trying to affect change that way. And it was, you know, it was very effective, and we created a lot of change, and I think saved a lot of lives over the course of the several years.
Yep. One of the things that comes to mind when you talk about the use of theater and media in a sense to affect change, I was thinking back to the film Philadelphia, which mm-hmm. Came out when I was born in 86. It came out in 93. So I was, you know, call it 7 years old. And it seems to me that film probably played a role, although, you know, in a sense was late to the game. Do you remember that film, and was it significant? I mean, and I was just even pulling it up on Wikipedia. I didn't realize this, but Tom Hanks won an Oscar for that year for that as best actor.
Yeah, I do remember that. And, you know, there were several kind of cultural milestones that really sort of propelled the conversation forward around AIDS. That certainly was one of them, because, you know, here you had a major motion picture where, the story kind of, you know, brought people in to, you know, what the, you know, what it was like, you know, to face discrimination and to be suffering from that disease at that time. And, you know, others, of course, were like when Rock Hudson, died brought attention to, the fact that anybody could get it, you know, and that, you know, you don't know who was potentially infected. And, you know, and it brought President Reagan and his wife's attention to the issue. So yeah, there were a lot of things that sort of brought it to the kitchen table discussion along the way, and that was
moving on. I mean, in the sense of like your career and going from, you know, organizing kind of on the grassroots level to affect change. I know you then moved into a role in the White House and also with the Department of Health after working at the HRC Human Rights Campaign. So can you then kind of shift gears to give a perspective and talk to us about what was it like working within the White House and U.S. Department of Health and, you know, kind of what were some of the outcomes you were able to drive? And then maybe what were some of the things you weren't able to get done, but you were hoping to?
Yeah, thanks. It is remarkable to think about somebody with a bachelor's in theater that, you know, goes from, you know, street action protests to, you know, working in the White House AIDS office. You know, when I was working for the Human Rights Campaign.
By the way, that's why I'm honored to have gotten to know you, although to date it's only been in a virtual setting, but it's really remarkable. And I think your career is really cool. And we get a lot of, you know, young people that are interested in affecting action and change in whatever ways. So I think your story is a really good example and inspiration. So I'll give you the floor back, but thank you for being here.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Stephen. You know, there was kind of like there were a lot of us in the AIDS protest field that were doing work that kind of propelled us beyond where we were really qualified to be. I will say that, and I don't mean that in a sense of false modesty, but you know, our education did not wouldn't suggest that we would become experts in biomedical clinical research, for example, or government policy and how to oversee that. And yet we were really driven by survival to learn what we had to do to be able to, you know, speak to those issues. And so, you know, so in San Francisco, I had been working in advocacy and education around HIV treatment. And then I went to become a lobbyist with the Human Rights Campaign, which is, you know, the largest LGBTQ rights organization in the country. And I was the only guy on the staff of, I think at the time was like 45 staff. And I was the only one that was specifically tasked with dealing with AIDS. So I felt like lonely there. Mm-hmm. We also helped to elect Bill Clinton. You know, the gay community really rallied behind him, and he was advocating for aggressive responses to the AIDS epidemic. And one of his promises he made was to form an AIDS czar office in the White House. So when he was elected, I hopped over to work in that new office. And I will tell you, it was a sharp learning curve for me. I had a fancy business card. The office was actually across the street from the White House complex, you know, upstairs from a McDonald's where Bill Clinton famously would get his hamburgers. And I was really kind of like shocked within a few months to realize how little power the White House AIDS coordinator had, the AIDS czar had. And you know, she was an amazing person, really sharp, competent around public policy, around public health. But she didn't have a portfolio. She was an advisor to the president on AIDS, and she didn't oversee the NIH and the FDA and the CDC and all the agencies that were responsible for responding to AIDS. And didn't oversee their budgets. And so when she would ask for things from them, they would like shrug, you know. And there were public policy issues that were very frustrating at the time, like needle exchange programs were still illegal according to federal law, unless the Secretary of Health and Human Services and the Surgeon General determined that it was the appropriate thing to do. And they wouldn't do it because it was a political hot potato, and so she couldn't get it done. So those kinds of, I wanted to get a Manhattan Project for AIDS yep. research going, which Clinton had also promised. And that was, frustrating. We did, working with activists, especially from ACT UP in New York and Treatment Action Group, managed to get some legislation through that reorganized the entire AIDS research effort at the NIH, which was amazing. When I worked for the federal government, we also formed a national task force on AIDS drug development, and I was the staff officer for that. So we got a lot of things done. That task force helped, I think, to accelerate the approval for protease inhibitors, which were the first mm-hmm. effective treatments for HIV. It's really hard, when you're inside the bureaucracy, it's really hard to see,
right.
cause and effect for anything that you do. You kind of bring people together and have conversations and hope that it's moving the conversation and the action forward. But in some ways, it kind of felt better to be outside on the street and just doing a sit-in,
Sure. Well, and yeah. as you've transitioned to a handful of different director and executive director roles at different organizations, and now again, to where you are today as executive director, what have been some of the lessons that you've learned, as you're leading these organizations? And how do you maybe manage or grow or govern things differently and lead differently over the years?
Well, I, I'm kind of a professional gay, so I've worked for a lot of different organizations. The kind of through line through all of it, though, has been to try to lift LGBTQ people up and, give them opportunity fight the kind of or really compensate for the kind of discrimination I think that we all feel and have felt throughout our lives in different ways, and some more than others. If there's anything that I've learned is that, the LGBTQ community it's kind of a misnomer in a sense. We're kind of a collection of different communities and subcultures, and what brings us together is our gender and sexuality differences from the quote unquote norm and the experiences that we've had around that. And so, I think bringing them together to have impact on creating change is often a challenge. I think listening and collecting people's ideas and kind of navigating, the differences of opinion and approach is always a challenge in community organizing. San Francisco is notorious for being extremely divided around, the best approach to effecting change. And so I think just the best way that I've found to navigate that is to listen and kind of any kind of a new idea, it has to emerge from the people who are most directly affected, or at least they have to feel like it, they own it, that they mm-hmm. they own it. And so kind of directing things from on high has never worked in terms of creating sustainable change. So the work that I'm doing right now with the Golden Gate Business Association is it's really interesting because, there are some aspects to the work that we do. We're the first LGBTQ chamber of commerce for LGBTQ people in the world, founded in 1974. And we're proud of that. It's kind of created a movement of LGBTQ business associations across the world. I think there's like 60 now. And we're also allies, you know, not just gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender businesses, but allies and corporations. And so problem solving things, it's been really interesting in the first, you know, 6 months on the job here, just to figure out, you know, what are the problems? What are the challenges? And some of them are unique to the LGBTQ community, but most of them are just the same challenges that everyone's facing. Coming out of the pandemic, a lot of businesses have closed. You know, people are just having trouble hiring employees, you know, paying their bills, adapting to the new business environment. You know, I mean, everything is disrupted and changed. And has been over and over again. It just seems to be accelerating now. And so adapting is something that we're trying to help to facilitate, but just really creating opportunities for people to do business with each other and with larger businesses is really just a key role that we're trying to like drive into.
How has, Terry, the Golden Gate Business Association either responded or been a part of the advancement in DEI initiatives over the past couple of years? You know, obviously starting with, you know, George Floyd and the Black Lives Matter movement. I know a lot of different, you know, organizations, for-profit businesses, nonprofit organizations have sort of tried to reevaluate and think really hard about how they're going to respond. But what's sort of that overlap? Because I think about, you know, individuals that are representing people from the LGBTQ community can sort of relate and maybe I would think be a, you know, supportive community.
Yeah. We're definitely, you know, a part of, I think, of that movement, and in a couple of ways in particular. First of all, internally, you know, we just have to look at ourselves as an organization, our board, our staff, our membership, and look at not just how diverse we are, but how inclusive we are in our programming and our decision making. And I think there's the challenges around that are really like just trying to be representative of the general population and especially the business community in San Francisco, which in and of itself has its own challenges. You know, there's been a lot of displacement around, you know, the growing economic divide that we have, you know, in the Bay Area. So there's been a lot of displacement and, you know, that's reflected, I think, in the business community and in our membership. So we have to continue to look at that. I think proactively, we externally also are creating programs, and we've created programs that are directed to those who are historically underrepresented or most challenged. You know, because the LGBTQ community is so diverse, we're as diverse as the general population, and so and as such, you know, we are also people of color. We're, of course, trans people and trans people of color. So there are sectors in the LGBTQ community that have been least advantaged and need the most support because, you know, they have, you know, economically and educationally have not had the same kinds of opportunities that everyone has as a whole or the larger group on average. And so I think, you know, so we have to be mindful of that and create programs that are specifically targeted to them. But externally also, just, you know, to keep in mind that the LGBTQ community itself is as a whole, underrepresented in the general population. And so experiences and has experienced discrimination in financing, in housing and employment. You know, we just recently got some degree of legal protection around, you know, who we love and who we marry. And, you know, that's very, very recent. Mm-hmm. And I'm just very mindful that, you know, it starts with families, communities, kids. Even here in the Bay Area, a lot of people think, education is in the schools is inclusive and respectful of gender and sexuality differences. You know, that's not always the experience on the ground. And I'm always conscious of the fact that the LGBTQ community has disproportionately high rates of social ills, impacts from this kind of discrimination, which include, you know, alcoholism and addiction, depression, suicide. And these are seen most among trans people, trans kids, young people in general. And so, you know, I mean, huge proportions. And this is in the Bay Area as well as around the country. And, you know, it has an impact when things, you know, laws are passed in places like, you know, Florida just passed the Don't Say Gay law, you know. And I can only imagine what that's like for, you know, a young gay kid growing up in school in Florida to be told that you can't even say the word, you know, gay. I knew I was, you know, different and gay when I was, you know, in kindergarten, which is, you know, and it's not about sexuality; it's about who we are. We know that we're different, you know, so this is a bit of a segue, but I'm just trying to give you the context of
I appreciate
who we are. For outside organizations, who the GGBA represents, you know, when like a corporate partner like, Wells Fargo or Google comes to us and wants us to come in, we do like a DEI training for their staff or a workshop, that kind of thing, because there's always room for growth and knowledge around our communities. Identities and the needs and challenges that we face.
Right on. How can you talk to us with respect to the Golden Gate Business Association? I know you're the first, and you're proud to be the first LGBTQ Chamber of Commerce. Can you talk to us about kind of your role in San Francisco, and then your role with National?
Oh, sure. You know, it's interesting. You know, San Francisco has a lot of different chambers and business associations, and we are working with them on different kinds of projects, advocacy in particular. So there's this San Francisco Chamber, which is the mainstay, and it includes gay members now of their board and their membership, but historically, you know, they were not always welcoming to the LGBTQ community, and so which really led to our forming in the 1970s. So, but there's also, you know, like the Filipino Chamber of Commerce, the Chinese American, the Hispanic Chambers of Commerce, African American Chamber of Commerce, and so there's a lot of overlap and intersection with these different groups. We have a couple hundred members throughout the Bay Area, so we collaborate on a lot of different kinds of projects. We're really just trying to support our LGBTQ businesses and helping them to get started, to grow, and to thrive. And it's a big part of the economy in the Bay Area. We're going to be pushing this spring into brand loyalty, just getting the residents and the visitors to San Francisco and the Bay Area to patronize LGBTQ businesses. And we're also really focused on getting our LGBTQ businesses certified, which is something I only learned about several months ago myself. Through our national organization, the National LGBT Chamber of Commerce, LGBTQ-owned businesses can get certified as being LGBT-owned. The reason to do that is because then you can access contracts with corporations and government agencies that have established supplier diversity goals. So a lot of the big corporations and agencies, they have billions of dollars of contracts that, services and products that they need to purchase every year. And, to their credit, they want to give a greater proportion of those opportunities to minority-owned, women-owned, veterans-owned, disabled-owned, and LGBTQ-owned businesses. And so we're part of that mix. And there's a lot of opportunity for growth around that. Just recently, the California Public Utilities Commission established a goal of 1.5% of all their contracts are to be directed to LGBTQ-owned businesses in California, which doesn't sound like a lot, 1.5%, but if every public agency and every corporation gave even 1.5% to LGBTQ-owned businesses, everything from construction to, decorating or, catering or, whatever it is, that would be, billions of dollars that would really lift up a lot of these small businesses that have been struggling and continue to struggle.
That's amazing. It's interesting you talk about that. It's unrelated specifically to your mission, but you talked about the concept of female-led businesses. My girlfriend recently opened a bakery, Bakery Cloud 9, shout out, in Austin. And oh, cool. I was, she started, it's female owned and all of her employees right now are all females. And, she's going to start to get it, the business certified. I think it's called Hub Certification or whatnot. Uh-huh. But I was just, telling her, hey, look, there's a real opportunity for you to grow your business, as a lot of these, companies or governmental agencies, want to be doing business with female owned businesses. And, you've got a cool opportunity here. So I think it's always good to kind of blend, wherever opportunities can be found to be able to bring those out. And I think that's really great that you all are, both pushing for that and using it as a resource for businesses that are a part of your community.
Yeah, that's awesome. Congratulations to your girlfriend.
Oh, thanks.
Starting a new business and getting certified as a woman-owned business is, I think, really important. And I will just say just briefly that it's not a perfect system, we really have to look at what corporations are and public agencies are actually doing to award those contracts and really push them to widen the net provide, make sure that your girlfriend's business hears about when they need baked good products.
Yes.
for an event, that it shouldn't be impossible to find those opportunities. And they should be proactive in recruiting her to do that. So best of luck to her.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point too. Terry, for those listening along, whether they're in San Francisco or, not in San Francisco, how can people learn more, get involved? What's kind of your message and your ask to listeners?
Yeah, thanks, Stephen. Absolutely. Thanks for helping me to do my job. We are welcoming not just to LGBTQ owned businesses, but to allied businesses throughout the Bay Area, even outside the Bay Area. If people are interested in joining, becoming a member, they can go to our website, ggba.com, and read all about us. We have a series of events that are happening every month. Many people can participate on them online or in person. You know, a big part of what we do is just social, you know, just social support, and people enjoy getting together and networking and, you know, sort of serendipitously arriving at, you know, just telling each other, you know, what they do and doing business with each other. And so we have a big event on June 17th during Pride Month, Power Connect, which is going to be bringing corporations and businesses together to imagine the new world of business as we move through and hopefully post COVID. Yeah, you can read about it on our website and subscribe to our newsletter and learn more about what we do there.
That's awesome. Well, I'm really proud and honored that you came on as a guest and getting to know you, Terry. Really is a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Stephen. Good luck with all your work.
Well, thank you so much. And to everyone listening, thank you again for being a part of the Charity Charge show. Today, we were just honored to have Terry Beswick, who is the executive director of the Golden Gate Business Association. Thanks again, Terry.
Thank you. Have a great day.